It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're going to talk about a leading cause of death in the United States, a condition that you may not even have heard of, sepsis. It strikes more than a million Americans every year, and many of those patients will die. Sepsis is a complication caused by the body's response to infection. It's difficult to identify and difficult to treat. We're going to find out a lot more about it this hour. I'll be talking with Dr. Patrick Slievert of the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine. But first, Kaylee Becker was a happy, healthy 17-year-old when she suddenly became very ill. What looked like flu initially turned out to be toxic shock syndrome, a form of sepsis. And this story has a happy ending, but it was a close call. And her mom is on the line with us today. Julie Becker is here. Hello, Julie.
Hello. How are you, Charity?
Very good. Thank you so much for being here. And so Kaylee was 17 years old.
She got
sick. What happened?
Well, she came home, and Kaylee, of course, was a senior in high school, and she was working part-time at a daycare facility. So initially, her symptoms were flu-like, so we assumed she had the flu. As the night progressed, she just could not keep anything down and became very ill. So the next morning, I took her to the ER, where they, again, said they thought it was the flu. And so they just pretty much gave her IV fluids to hydrate her and some nausea medicine and said, it's the flu. It'll be a couple days and you'll be good to go. So we went home, and as the day progressed, she her temperature went up, which I can count on one hand how many times she's had a temp. So we knew that there's something else going on. It ended up being 103 at that point. So I called her pediatrician, who again, I gave him the symptoms that she had. She was vomiting, diarrhea, and at that point, in the fever. So again, he thought it was the flu. He said, wait until morning. And so we did. And the next day, she ended up with bloodshot eyes and swollen ankles. So I called the doctor's office again, and the nurse dismissed those symptoms as being part of having the fever, the bloodshot eyes, and the swollen ankles she thought was from the IV fluids that they had given her in the hospital. So by Sunday, we ended up, I ended up taking her back to a different ER and just said, there is something going on. On the way down to the hospital, she was having trouble breathing. Her fever, of course, was still elevated. What we didn't realize is her blood pressure was dropping. And she was an athlete, so she always had low blood pressure, but it just continued to drop. They admitted her and said, again, they thought it was flu. But then there was an intern or a resident that came in from the University of Iowa, and he asked to see her legs, which we thought was kind of odd, but she had a rash, which we had no idea she even had. It was, you know, winter and she had sweats on, and she had a little bit of a rash under her chin, and he initially thought it was Kawasaki disease. So it was, you know, a guessing game. The pediatrician, she that was on call, thank God, had dealt with TSS, so he came in, took a culture, ran it himself, and at that point, they're moving her up to peds because she's 17, and they put her on IV fluids. Her organs started to shut down. Her blood pressure went way down, and her temp was 104 point something. It was just ridiculously high. So at that point, it was really scary. They didn't know if she was going to make it through or not. So, it, like I said, you know, not knowing anything about sepsis at that point, just thinking she has the flu, and then you find out that her organs are shutting down and you don't know if she's, you know, they basically said she was probably 4 hours away from dying.
Oh my gosh.
So that's kind of the story in a nutshell. But
so when they finally figured out what was going on, I mean, she spent 7 days in the hospital.
Yep. They had to pump her with 23 pounds of IV fluid to get her organs working again. She wasn't urinating. Things were shutting down on her. And also to get her blood pressure back up. So that was the scariest part. There were a couple days where she was critical, and it was just a waiting game. And thankfully, she came out of it and this has been a little over a year later, she still has some memory issues, short-term memory loss that she's working on. She's doing really well. She's at University of Northern Iowa, straight A's. But she has to study, you know, and she had hair loss and her fingers peeled. But, you know, she's very lucky she didn't lose a limb or her life.
Absolutely. So eventually is the expectation that she will make a full recovery?
Absolutely. She will make a full recovery. But the problem is she's always susceptible now. So anytime she gets a cut or an infection of any sort, we worry. And we just have to make sure that, like with the University of Northern Iowa, I have met with the health clinic to let them know her history. So if she comes in with any type of infection, it's kind of a big deal that we get her the proper care right away. And that's the key is, you know, if they would have known the first day that I took her to the ER that, you know, and that's what we are advocates about is just ask questions. Like she was menstruating. Now, if they would have asked that question, they might have caught it that day in the ER. So just trying to educate people on questions to ask, you know, a teenage girl with flu-like symptoms, are you menstruating? Right there could save a life.
Well, and Julie, it sounds like you did everything you could do, and you did save your daughter's life by being such a great advocate for her in seeking care. Thank you so much for sharing your story with us today.
You bet. Thank you.
Julie Becker of Cedar Rapids, her daughter Kaylee survived toxic shock syndrome, which is a kind of sepsis. We're talking about sepsis this hour, which is a leading cause of death in the United States and something that we rarely hear about. With me now is Dr. Patrick Slievert. He is professor and chair in the Department of Microbiology in the Carver College of Medicine at the University of Iowa and one of the world's leading experts on septic shock. Dr. Slievert, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thank you for the invitation.
Now, I think we need to define our terms here because we were talking with Julie about her daughter having toxic shock syndrome. We're talking about sepsis this hour. So toxic shock syndrome is something that most of us are familiar with if we've read the insert in a package of tampons. But explain to me the relationship here.
Okay. So all of us live every day with about 10,000 times more bacteria than there are people in the world. And so those bacteria are normally kept in check and don't harm us because of our normally functioning immune system. But sometimes things don't work right. And, you know, so in the case of Kaylee, she was using a tampon, a particular tampon, and she had a bacterium staph aureus. Okay, so sepsis then, or septic shock, is defined as either those bacteria figure out how to outsmart the immune system or their products do. So in her case, it was a toxin that Staph aureus was making that was causing the disease. But likewise, a lot of bacteria themselves get in the bloodstream. And likewise, there's another whole group of bacteria that makes something called endotoxin. So and when those products get into the bloodstream, they cause our own immune system to cause this disease in us.
So our immune system is actually attacking us.
Yes. Okay. So the main symptoms, and this is what Kaylee had, the main symptoms are extremely high fever. And that's these agents that do this, all of them, whether they be the bacteria, the toxin like Kaylee had, or this other molecule that I talked about, which we know as endotoxin, they cause extremely high fever. The other thing, and they do that through effects on the immune system, the other thing that they do is cause the release of a molecule. We know it as tumor necrosis factor. It's a complicated name, but it's nothing more than a protein that causes the bloodstream to leak. And so then fluid leaves the bloodstream. And blood flow doesn't work very well when you don't have fluid in it. And then that also leads to then clotting within the blood, in the blood vessels. And, of course, now the kidney's going to shut down. So the only way people can clear these bacteria or the toxins or poisons is by excreting them out the kidneys. But the kidneys are shutting down. So it just keeps cycling then worse and worse and worse. And to give you, put it in perspective, it takes about a tenth of a grain of salt worth of these products, if you will, to cause this problem, to cause our immune system to do this to us. So it's an extremely tiny amount.
Now, it's such a common cause of death. I've read many different statistics about sepsis at this point. I was quoting more than a million Americans. That seems to be fairly undisputed. At least 100,000, if not more, Americans dying of sepsis-related incidents every year. But why don't we hear sepsis more often as a cause of death?
Well, okay, so sepsis itself doesn't normally happen. So even though we live with all these bacteria, they're on our surfaces. They're on our mucous membranes. You know, when you have a bowel movement, that's mostly bacteria. But we contain them. But it's when they get inside our bodies that they cause trouble. And that happens when somebody has surgery or somebody has influenza, pneumonia, or somebody has cancer and is irradiated or has chemotherapy.
We'll pick up here in just a moment. We're going to take a short break. We're talking about sepsis this hour, one of the leading causes of death in the United States and around the world. My guest is Dr. Patrick Slievert of the Carver College of Medicine at the University of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about sepsis, which is a leading cause of death in the United States and around the world. More than a million people in the United States every year are struck with sepsis. And simply put, we're talking about what it is, but simply put, it's a complication caused by the body's response to infection. With me, Dr. Patrick Slievert. He's professor and chair in the Department of Microbiology, Carver College of Medicine at the University of Iowa. And Dr. Slievert, just before the break, we were talking about how incredibly common this is, but how seldom we see septic shock or sepsis listed as a cause of death. In fact, I just learned recently the former host of this program, Greg Shanley, died in 2010, and septic shock was actually his cause of death. It was a complication that arose from diabetes. And that's what we seem to see listed a lot, complication that arose from diabetes or complication that arose from cancer, complication that arose from the flu. This is what people who die of the flu die of, right?
That is correct. So there is Tony Fauci, who is head of the National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Disease at NIH, and I had a discussion about this. He, you know, his argument was people are dying of the flu. And I said, no, they're dying of secondary complications. And it's important to tell people that so that they can be treated for the sepsis that they're getting. So it was 2 months later he published a paper saying I was right on that. Okay, so what you said is absolutely true. People are dying of complications of something else. So it's listed as something else that people are dying of. And the harm in that is that what it so NIH is a funding agency, and they give money for diseases to do research on diseases. So I've actually gone back and looked. And if we start with September 2001, the United States has spent $16 billion on biodefense, and that's because of the anthrax scare, which is also sepsis. Okay, so only about 8 people have been, or 12 people have been affected by that. But in the same time period, 100 million people have had septic shock, And as you said, 100,000 die every year. Yet we only spend $2 per person on research on septic shock. So our money isn't going where it needs to go. And a lot of that is because of what you said. What's reported out isn't septic shock. So there are very, very few people actually studying the disease and how we can do something about it. Because there are things we can do.
So it's important to know the name of what is killing people because it will lead us to focus on working on that in research. But what does it mean to me? Let's say I get sick or someone in my family gets sick. Why is it important that I know what sepsis is? How can I protect myself or someone I love against it?
Well, so I started the publicity a long time ago on toxic shock syndrome, on the menstrual version of this disease, because I couldn't get the medical community to listen that there was a disease. And I felt it's time for Americans to take control of their own health care. So the more you know, the more questions you can ask. And a lot of women went in and said, or their mothers went in and said, is it possible that my daughter has menstrual toxic shock syndrome? It's always helpful if you have some information. A lot of doctors don't like people going on the internet and finding things, but it's actually helpful if you have a good sense of what might be going on. I'm reminded of a woman who took her daughter in 12 times, and she actually had septic shock. She didn't have menstrual toxic shock syndrome, but the daughter had septic shock. She lost four limbs. Okay, now the mom knew that something was wrong, and she was trying to convince the doctors of this. There was a major lawsuit. It was actually written up in a publication also. But those kind of things shouldn't happen. And the more people take responsibility for their health care, the better off we'll be. And so I see nothing wrong with going in and saying, is it possible that this is what my daughter has or my son or I have?
So knowing to ask the right questions is where the power lies for an individual, a non-doctor. It sounds like this is, and I know that this has been a big part of your career, but it's something doctors need to be more aware of as well.
And I think, and you're absolutely right, I think part of the same thing is, you know, doctors go through a very extensive training in a lot of areas. And, you know, there's kind of a lot of fashionable areas like heart disease, cancer, eye diseases, et cetera. Infectious diseases, if you go back to when Ronald Reagan was president, he thought there was no reason to have infectious disease people anymore because infectious diseases don't cause a problem because of antibiotics. Well, we know that's not true because antibiotic resistance is a serious problem. People are getting all kinds of procedures that's altering their immune system and their ability to handle these infections. And so what we see is infections are actually going up, and we're getting significant number of deaths. The funding and the understanding that goes with that has not kept up with it, and that's what we, like at the University of Iowa, need to keep pushing.
We're talking about sepsis this hour, one of the leading causes of death in the United States and around the world. Dr. Patrick Slievert is here with me from the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine. And earlier we talked about a septic shock survivor, Kaylee Becker, a young woman at the age of 17. It's something that strikes people of all ages, young and old. And my next guest is also a survivor of sepsis. He's a survivor of many things. Bob Foster has had a long career as a broadcaster. He's now at AM 1650, The Fan. He's also had a long history of health struggles. He was diagnosed with leukemia in 1996. He had a bone marrow transplant in 2012. And he's had some close calls with sepsis. He's here with us now. Hi, Bob.
Good morning. Thank you for the opportunity.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And as I mentioned, I mean, your journey with the healthcare system has been long and difficult. Your experiences with leukemia have been really nothing short of miraculous that you are still here talking with us today. But Bob, tell me about your experiences with sepsis. Do you remember the first time that you had it and how it came about?
Well, that would be probably the least dramatic. But if you don't mind, I'll just go ahead and say I've had it seven times.
Wow.
Seven. And I'll share maybe two of the most dramatic,
okay,
only because it's a good indication of how we often, even though we've had experience with things, We still develop this denial, or we think it's something other than the condition that it really is, and we don't pay proper attention to it until it's now emergency time. I had that bone marrow transplant, as you mentioned, and I'd contracted pneumonia twice before that, and had the sepsis experience. But after transplant, and I stayed in Rochester, Minnesota, we had that done at Mayo. They require you to stay 100, 120 days to be near in case something goes wrong. And I had bloodborne infections three times with the chills, the rigors, the shaking, and then had to have, you know, a lot of heavy antibiotics to get that clear. I was hospitalized for a week each time. And part of that, after transplant, one must remember that you are on, different immunosuppressants. These, Dr. Slievert will recognize them, like cyclosporin is one. You take a significant dose to suppress your immune system to allow the body to adjust, let's say, to having those new stem cells in. But two of the most dramatic, one happened on a fishing trip a couple of years post-transplant. I was in way in the deep north woods of Minnesota. It's an area I love so much. Hadn't been there a long time. My wife and I went up there. And I felt fatigued. Every day, I'd only fish about a half a day, and I'd have to bring my equipment up the hill back to the cottage. I'm like, boy, I must be really getting out of shape. Well, I woke up on a Friday morning, and I was chilled. I was shaking. I felt, gosh, I got the window open here in the bedroom in the cottage. Maybe I just need another blanket. I tried that. Didn't work. Now, remember, this was probably my fifth or sixth episode, and I still was in denial. And I thought, well, I'm just cold. Well, by the time, let's say, 6 o'clock or daybreak came along, I realized I was in serious trouble. My wife got me in the car, and I'm shaking uncontrollably. She rushed me about 7-8 miles to a small critical access hospital in Big Fork, Minnesota. A shout-out to them this morning because they were very competent. They diagnosed it immediately and properly, and they got a helicopter on the way from St. Mary's in Duluth.
Wow.
Airlifted me out of the deep woods. My wife, who has been my primary caregiver, and I mean a rock through all this. I almost start to choke up when I think of what she's done to get me through all this. She was just like, what am I going to do? And we've got all our things back at the cottage. I don't know Duluth. How am I going to get there? They lift me off in the helicopter, whisk me away to St. Mary's, and by the time I got there, I had a fever of 104. Which, you know, we heard that earlier, mm-hmm. is not unusual. My blood pressure was around 70 over 40, 80 over 40, so I was in serious trouble. I saw the CT scan, or the X-ray, excuse me, of my left lung while I was lying in the ICU, and was fully engaged with pneumonia. It was just horrible. A week later, I'm out. All right, we're good. About, I want to say, among, it was 9/11, 2015. I'm at work at the radio station you mentioned. I'm not feeling good again. And the rigors kicked in. I called 911.
When you say rigors, what?
The
what
shaking.
Okay.
It feels like chills, and you're shaking uncontrollably. You just can't stop it. Called 911. Ambulance took me to a local hospital in Waterloo. Immediately, they transferred me back to Mayo. I was at Rochester Methodist for 3 months.
Wow.
I was intubated for a couple of days. Horrible pneumonia. Pseudomonas was one of the infections. Again, I'm sure Dr. Slievert is nodding his head. He's very familiar with that. And it wasn't until about a year afterwards when my medical team finally admitted, you know, we thought we were going to lose you. So I want to echo what Dr. Slievert said. It's a small amount of bacteria. It's something that you least expect. And I'm still a little immunosuppressed. I'm on prednisone to help with a little graft versus host disease, which is a whole other conversation. But it can strike suddenly, and maybe Dr. Slievert can address this. One of the things they told us at Mayo, though, is if you're spiking that fever, so oftentimes people want to take ibuprofen, Tylenol, whatever, to try to, you know, take care of the fever.
Reduce the fever, yeah.
Yeah, but it masks the condition. It'll mask the fever, and you think, well, I'm okay. I guess that's all it was. And then, of course, it wears off and it worsens. So my advice is get to your provider, if it even means getting to the ER to have the labs run, because you never know, and it could be a life-saving move on your part to get and be seen.
Well, and even with you saying that maybe you were a little bit of denial, thinking I'm not mm-hmm. that sick, you recognized it pretty quickly in the examples that you gave us? I mean, quickly compared to what someone who didn't have experience with that.
I'll use the old analogy of the story of, you know, the farmer hitting the mule over the head with a 2x4. You know, eventually you've got to get your attention, and sooner or later you realize, wow, you know, this is like the fifth, the sixth, the seventh time in my case. It's like, okay, I got it. But one of the things that I found is, and maybe it's just my personality, and my wife is listening at home and she's probably nodding her head now. I'm a very stubborn, headstrong guy. And oftentimes people think that they can, I can cope with this. I can shake this off. I know what it is. And you can't. You've got to get the proper care and the proper diagnosis.
Well, Bob, I'm glad you're with us. And thank you so much for sharing your story today.
Well, I thank you. And I do. I'll just throw this out there. With all I've been through, I give God the glory. That's why I'm here today.
Bob Foster, thanks a lot. Bob Foster has had a long career as a broadcaster, sepsis 7 times. He is definitely a survivor. And Dr. Slievert, Bob's story, I'm sure, resonates a lot with you. So as somebody who's been through so much, I mean, tell me, who is most at risk for sepsis?
Okay, so could I just say one thing related to what he was saying, and I think it's a point worth emphasizing again. So there is a really important reason to get the flu shot, and because about 30,000 people die every year in this country by having the flu, and even though healthcare has gotten better, it's still about 30,000. They're not dying of the flu; they're dying of sepsis following the flu. So how can you tell the difference?
Okay, yes.
And
good,
you know,
question.
We heard. Yeah, okay. So we heard Kaylee's discussion about how the physicians thought she had the flu. So what I tell people is you've got two things: fever and dizziness upon standing. Dizziness upon standing is a sign that your blood pressure is getting low. Okay, so in the regular influenza or any respiratory infection, if you start to get better, and then all of a sudden you start to get worse. Okay, so your fever goes back up, and you get dizzy when you stand up. I would get to the doctor, ER, as fast as you can, because the potential is that in the next several hours you will die. Okay, so, and people, yeah, they like to be tough. They like whatever. That's not what you want to be here. What you want to do is get it dealt with right away. So anybody that goes in, you know, for a transplant or cancer therapy, is clearly at risk, and every hospital will tell them that they're at risk. But you still need to keep, always have it in the front of your mind that it can happen. Anybody that, whether they know it or not, cirrhosis, diabetes. Two of my neighbors died of Staph aureus sepsis, association with diabetes. They were originally missed because they thought they had kidney stones, and then the next day the kidney doubled in size, and then the kidney basically on these exploded, seeded the rest of the body, and over the course of a month the individuals died, and these things are, you know, I mean, this is the least of the concern, but these are incredibly expensive, being in an ICU and for months. I have a friend who was in an ICU, unconscious basically for 6 months with sepsis, and they're incredibly difficult to manage. So those.
But what you're telling me goes against what we're hearing from a lot of other places, which is about overuse or abuse of our healthcare system and going to the doctor when you don't need to go to the doctor. I mean, you need to be aware of this.
That's right. You need to be responsible for your own health. And even if you go in and they tell you, I think you've got the flu. If it's a 12 to 15-year-old girl and they've got the flu during the menstrual period, there's a good chance that that's going to turn into toxic shock syndrome, and you need to say, I think this might turn into toxic shock syndrome. That's not overuse or abuse of the healthcare system. I think it's being responsible. I think, you know, there's always concern about overuse of antimicrobials, but when you have somebody that's deathly ill, the object is to keep them alive. I always teach medical students, and I always say it's better to be alive than dead, right? Okay, so do the things that are necessary to keep the patients alive. Yes, it's going to be expensive, costly. You know, it seems like maybe overuse of the healthcare system, But we're humans. That's the job of the physicians.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. This hour, we're talking about sepsis, one of the leading causes of death in the United States and around the world. With me, Dr. Patrick Slievert. He's professor and chair in the Department of Microbiology at the Carver College of Medicine at the University of Iowa, one of the world's leading experts on septic shock. And we will take your calls and your questions when we get back from a break. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.com. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour we're talking about sepsis or septic shock, one of the leading causes of death in the United States. And with me, Dr. Patrick Slievert, professor and chair in the Department of Microbiology at the Carver College of Medicine at the University of Iowa. You are welcome to join our conversation as well. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org is our email address. We're going to talk more about treatment for septic shock in a moment, but we have a couple of people I want to bring into the conversation. Here's an email from Chuck in Kelowna. He said, I'm a sepsis survivor. In December of 2014, I was diagnosed with the flu. 24 hours later, I was admitted to the University of Iowa hospitals and clinics with very low blood pressure and soon suffered two cardiac arrests in the ER before being admitted to the ICU. My kidneys were shutting down, and I was on a respirator because of acute respiratory distress syndrome. Thanks to the terrific care provided by the UIHC staff and the prayers of friends, family, and strangers, I survived and recovered. I returned to teaching at the University of Iowa in the summer of 2015, where I remain. The longer-term impact was the loss of my toes due to lack of blood flow to my feet. I'm very fortunate because others lose lower legs, digits, and even forearms. And I want to go to the phones. Jeffrey is on the line in Iowa City, also a septic shock survivor. Hello, Jeffrey.
Hello, Charity. Thank you for taking the call. I really appreciate this program. It's ironic that Chuck just sent in his email. He and I know each other well. I want to emphasize that healthy individuals can find themselves in real trouble within 12 hours with septic shock. I was very active in the summer of 2013, great weight, hiking across England, restoring an old corn crib, chopping firewood, doing lots of very active middle-aged things, and went to move my son, went into a care clinic thinking I had the flu, and they sent me home thinking I had the flu even after a blood test. 6 hours later, I was on the floor of the emergency room with a blood pressure of 60 over 30, and after many months of care both at Stanford Hospital and the University of Iowa, I ended up with loss of lower limbs and loss of most of the ends of all of my fingers.
Oh, wow.
So I only have little stubs for fingers left. The point isn't really what happened to me, because it's not that unique among septic survivors, but that we need to understand that it's not just the person who's been diabetic or not just the person who's had transplants or not just the person who's had ongoing immune system problems, but for some reason, even a healthy individual can find themselves in real trouble in a very short amount of time if they're not paying attention. And I look forward to meeting the doctor because I've been active in an international sepsis group and do a lot of fundraising in the local community, and we should talk.
Well, Jeffrey, thank you so much for calling and sharing your story. And that does really underline exactly what you were saying, that a healthy individual can be struck with, or a seemingly healthy individual can be struck with sepsis and be in serious trouble very fast.
Can I comment on that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So the in 1987, Larry Cohn and I described a new disease that emerged that we published it in the New England Journal of Medicine. It became known as the flesh-eating strep disease, and it affects very, very rapidly, like the caller was suggesting, and I'm not sure that's what he had, but it It is one of those. And I know we recently had a boy from Dubuque that was in the news and was seen at the University of Iowa that had the same disease. These are apparently healthy people. But the organism still gets in a minor break in the skin and or a minor break in the throat, something like that. So it we're otherwise healthy, but there is still some minor break. And that's all it takes. Once it gets in, it can progress, as the caller said, extremely rapidly. I think the key thing is, again, when you have a high fever, so if you have a fever that goes up to 103 degrees, that's a sign that you have a significant bacterial infection. If you have dizziness upon standing, don't wait. Go in and get it looked at. Insist that they figure out, you know, are you developing sepsis? Because sometimes you can have to kind of be pushy to get your point across.
Advocate for yourself.
And there have been outbreaks of this. You know, I was recalling in the Rochester Wanamingo area.
How can there
area.
Be outbreaks? What is there a particular bacteria that would have been spreading in a particular area? I mean, this sounds like it's caused by many different bacteria.
Well, okay, sepsis, the vast majority are caused by bacteria that live in us. But there's are particular forms that don't. So like the flesh-eating strep disease. Mm-hmm. In children, that causes strep sore throat. But if adults or other individuals get it in breaks in the skin, it will cause this very life-threatening disease. And in that what we call the Rochester Wanamingo outbreak, there were 16 cases clustered. 8 of those people died. Okay, and they died very, very rapidly. Okay, so some organisms are in us all the time. E. coli, we all know the name. That's probably the most common cause of sepsis. And that would be through some immune compromising thing like radiation, chemotherapy, or diabetes, something like that. But group A strep would be an organism from the outside that could do it.
Let's talk about treatment, because obviously identifying it early is good. The sooner you get treatment, the better. How is sepsis treated?
Well, okay, so the reason people get into trouble is because of drop in blood pressure. And if the fever is too high, you have to put them on cooling blankets or something like that. But the major problem is the drop in blood pressure. You have to get blood pressure up. And when the blood pressure is too low, the heart gets irritated, and a lot of time it stops. So cardiac arrest is a lot of times the cause of death. So you need to get it with fluid, and then they'll put electrolytes in there so that the fluid is balanced. So the real problem in septic shock is fluid going into the tissues. So some of these people swell up like the Michelin tire man, and they can take 15 liters of fluid, or like 15 quarts of fluid a day. And so you have to get the blood pressure up so that the kidneys start functioning, so that the kidneys function as get rid of toxins. And the body makes toxins also, not just the microbe, but you need to get rid of those. So that the major treatment is to get fluid and electrolytes to keep the blood pressure up. And then you have to use antibiotics. And normally it would be a group of antibiotics initially until you know what the cause is. So you need to have broad spectrum. And then once you figure it out, you can narrow it down. And so the key thing is figure out what it is. Okay, so in Kaylee's case, and maybe in this one of the person that called in, IVIG, there is a pool of antibodies that are available commercially. One treatment is $8,000 for it, but it has antibodies to all different kinds of things that cause septic shock. And so if people are put on that immediately, a lot of times that turns them around immediately. So it's a combination of multiple antibiotics, the right ones, the most important thing, fluid electrolytes, and then in special cases to use things like IVIG. Necrotizing pneumonia, for example, or pneumonia, which is a very common one following flu, every kid should be put on, in my estimation, should be put on IVIG just automatically.
So we read a lot about bacterial resistance to antibiotics. That is a growing problem in the United States. There was a story just in the last week about a woman who was treated with every kind of antibiotic possible and still died because whatever she had was resistant. So is this getting harder to treat because of antibiotic resistance?
Yes. There's now recognition of what we call escape pathogens, and that's because they escape antimicrobial resistance. But they include all the common things like E. coli and staph and Klebsiella pseudomonas, the ones that we all in the field recognize as very important. And a lot of them are becoming antimicrobial resistance. There is now a very strong push by the government to develop new antibiotics. I myself have a company that, you know, that are trying to develop novel antimicrobials where there's no chance of resistance. So the problem with antibiotics is that if you have one antibiotic, one bacterium in 10 million, and 10 million bacteria is the size of the head of a pin. So one in there is a resistant already to that antibiotic. Bacteria mutate incredibly rapidly. So when you have somebody with a really serious disease, you would want to use multiple antibiotics, right? Because it would be, let's just say you use three, it would be one in 10 million times one in 10 million times one in 10 million. So it'd be one in 10 to the 21. So it's not going to happen, basically, an astronomically low number. So that's one way to avoid it. But physicians are told, don't overuse antibiotics. And so we're in kind of
Because, I mean, that is a major problem contributing to antibiotic resistance.
That's correct. It is. But I think more of it is there's more problem with using one antibiotic too often and perhaps at a suboptimal amount. So there's a lot of people in Iowa and other states that are in long-term care facilities, and they're chronically catheterized. 100% of them will develop urinary tract infections over and over and over, and it'll steadily lead to decline of their brain function. You have to treat those people, and a lot of times they're just empirically treated with an antibiotic that usually works. Well, sometimes it doesn't work. And what it does then is it leads to resistance, and then that organism gets passed around. And so that's where these are coming from. It's kind of not really knowing what the real antibiotic should be used. And so we need to be more responsible about it, but we need to treat serious diseases with these antibiotics. And hopefully some of us can come up with these new antimicrobials where there's really no chance of antimicrobial resistance. I think that's really going to be the future.
We have this tweet from Brad. He said, I was having back pain that kept me awake all night. I went to the emergency room, and they said they couldn't find anything. They suggested I get ibuprofen and a heating pad. Less than a week later, it got worse. I went back and spent over a week in the hospital with sepsis. Seems like patients aren't the only ones unfamiliar with it. And obviously, this whole hour, we've been talking a lot about raising awareness about sepsis. And you've done a lot to raise awareness about sepsis. And even during the break, you were telling me that after the death of Jim Henson, which, you know, most of us believe Jim Henson died of pneumonia. He died of septic shock, the great Muppeteer. There was a rise in awareness, and the treatment for sepsis seemed to get better. The death rates decreased. Now we're on the rise again.
That is correct. So when Larry Cohn and I first described that disease, and Jim Henson died just a few years later, because I was actually involved in his care. The awareness was up. So when first described, the case fatality rate or the fatality rate for that form of sepsis was 85%, and half of the survivors had limbs amputated. So with a lot of changes in medical care and a lot of us pushing really hard to get changes in medical care, the case fatality rate went down to 30%. Then when it stopped being in the media all the time and a lot less awareness, now it's back up in some places over 60%, but in the 50 to 60% range. And so what it says is, like what I try to do every fall, I try to contact all the news media and remind them to tell people that flu doesn't kill. Secondary infections after the flu kills people, and that they should keep pressing that point in all of their news stories. And I see more and more people doing that. But that's the only way we're going to get awareness of what actually does kill people.
I mentioned earlier that there are so many people who die of septic shock and we don't know it because, let's say in their obituary, the other cause of death, the thing that led to the septic shock, like diabetes, like cancer, like pneumonia, that's the thing that's listed. Would you advocate for changing how we report deaths and cause of death?
Yes, I absolutely would. I'm also part of unexplained death projects. And so far in the unexplained, these are people that have died for, and nobody really knows why. Even on autopsy, they can't figure it out. but I can do a lot of tests that help in here. And so far we find that maybe 20 to 30% of these unexplained deaths end up being septic shock. So I think that, yes, absolutely. You could still list that the person died of cancer, but you should say that was the, you know, the underlying problem. But the real cause of death was septic shock. Because it's only with that are we going to get more research done. Because there are very few people studying how to keep people alive with this. It's really shocking to me. Very surprising.
Right. We don't have 5Ks dedicated to raising awareness and money for septic shock. We don't. It's not one of the diseases that we're advocating for.
That's correct.
So I think a lot of us really do depend on our doctors to know this and be aware of this. So is that part of the problem, too? I mean, we've talked about doctors not necessarily being able to diagnose it. How do you raise awareness in the medical community?
Well, I think, you know, we as educators have to keep bringing it up. But I think it's also our responsibility to interact with people like you so that we can keep awareness in the community. And, you know, I spent a lot of time in Minnesota, and Minnesota has an incredible health department. And they work really, really hard to make sure the whole state of Minnesota and everybody knows. And I think that's why their healthcare system is number two. And I think by, you know, talking to you and other news media, this is our chance to really affect the state of Iowa, to get healthcare and to get the septic shock right at the forefront. We all have family members who have been seriously affected by that. We just may not recognize it.
So if somebody's listening right now, they've just learned about sepsis, what's the number one thing you want them to take away so that they can advocate for themselves or for a loved one in case of sepsis?
Well, right now, my number one thing would be to say, be aware that influenza does not kill people. Secondary infections do. Get a flu shot. But if you're not going to get the flu shot, remember that when you start to get better with the flu, if you start getting sick again, go in immediately because you're on a path that could lead to your death in a few hours. If you're during a menstrual period and you start getting, again, 103 degree fever, tells you there's a serious infection in there. Everybody should go in when they get that. I don't care what it is. They should be going in to find out and push the issue. And a sign of sepsis is dizziness upon standing.
All right. Dr. Patrick Slievert, thank you so much.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Dr. Patrick Slievert, professor and chair in the Department of Microbiology at the Carver College of Medicine at the University of Iowa. We've been talking about sepsis this hour, one of the leading causes of death. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.